Hello, my name is Philip Meriton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Meriton.
Now, each week on this show, we try to push the envelope a little farther in the direction of understanding ourselves and the world, and this is not an easy task because there's a lot to understand. But if we take one step at a time, we may find that at the end of the journey, we will at least learn more about ourselves and the world than we did when we started. Now, the key, I think, to this task is to try to break through the common beliefs and perceptions that we hold. But needless to say, this is an inner journey. For these common beliefs, such as stereotypes of religions, nationalities, the authority of science, political parties, etc., etc., are ingrained somewhere inside. They're not out in the walls, TV sets, or the front lawn. This is an inner journey that we must take. Now, along the same lines, there's an important ingredient to breaking through these beliefs and perceptions, and this is something known as an open mind. Now, an open mind has both practical and spiritual or philosophical aspects to it. And maybe it's the same principle applied to both practical wisdom and the spiritual wisdom. For example, we know that one saying is variety is the spice of life. Well, in order to have the experience of variety, you have to have an open mind to the variety. You can't close off different types of experiences. So today what we're going to do is we're going to have a discussion about the importance of open-mindedness. And I'm very pleased to have as a guest on today's show, Tim Boyd, who is the national president of the Theosophical Society of America, and he's also the editor-in-chief of Quest Magazine. Thank you for joining me, Tim.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Philip.
Okay, so now what I want to do, and the reason why I want to start off about the importance of being open-minded, and that is open to new ideas, beliefs, foods, gadgets, or whatever, is because the concept or the term theosophy itself is something that I would think a lot of people, have preconceived notions over what the term means. Mm-hmm. I was just saying that I've driven by the Theosophical Society myself, and in the early days, it sounds like maybe some kind of sect or some kind of cult or something that believes in strange creatures or angels or some kind of group of people that have beliefs different than everybody else. And in fact, when you get into it, I don't think that that's what theosophy means. And so Tim, let's start things off by having you describe what theosophy is.
Well, you don't believe in starting with the easiest things first, obviously,
Philip. We'll book it right to it.
Well, just in terms of the actual word itself, obviously, when people first hear it, it's not something that's in most people's normal vocabulary, but they recognize theo, they recognize sophy from philosophy or theology. And so often they get those terms kind of intermixed. And that's not completely off base, because you know, the word itself speaks to, you could call it divine wisdom. Theosophia is the Greek root. And the idea behind it is pretty simple and pretty consistent with most people's spiritual outlook, which would say that there is some way of knowing and there is some body of knowledge that reaches beyond the ordinary sphere of our thinking. And so theosophy really relates to that. And the idea that each one of us is part of something bigger. I mean, I think many people want to feel that way, but somehow we've been kind of convinced that somehow we're just little powerless individuals, but that really everybody has some sort of sense that there's a deeper level of connection. But to understand what that is problematic for most people.
Yeah, so yeah, go ahead.
One of the things theosophy talks about is, you know, those various sorts of issues.
The beginning of wisdom to many people and to many belief philosophical systems is something that maybe we call it the pure mind, the Zen mind. John Locke, the British philosopher, had his blank tablet, which I don't think he was saying the same thing, but it gives the impression that in order to receive wisdom, you must start with a pure or child mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what happens, and to me, a lot of the spiritual traditions, they want to start with that standpoint. And I think the other day someone was describing what mediation is, and it's something where thought stops or something, where the brain stops moving, and so you're trying to have a pure state. And I think the question is, and this is always the question to me in the spiritual traditions, is whether at that state, that pure mind state, you are getting closer to what truth, reality really is. And I'm wondering whether there's a connection in your mind between, you know, open-mindedness, pure mind, and something that we want to call the truth.
Well, I think there definitely is. When we talk about being open-minded, I mean, you're using the term pure mind, which I think is a good one, or uncolored mind is sometimes the way that it's even described. And it's something that conversationally it's easy to say. But of course, we have so many different things imprinted in us from our DNA to our education that have a way of building prejudices into us.
Yes.
So it gets very difficult to kind of expose ourselves to something more. But I do believe, you know, as you say, that if it's possible for us to conceive of it, I mean, if it's small enough that it can fit within a normal sort of person's conception, then probably we could say that's not the truth. But, you know, to actually experience what is begins with the requirement, as you say, for some degree of openness in our mind and in our thought.
I tend to think that you sort of have to begin with an open mind when you evaluate any idea, and because that's the only way you're ever going to be able to critically examine the truth of a proposition. And today in the scientific worldview, there's a lot of literature that describes science as being, as I've said in the past, the objective search for truth. And the word objective has this connotation, at least, of being open. And in fact, there's plenty of scientists and philosophers of science who use the word open-minded search for truth. But it seems to me that what today's science is talking about is something different than the spiritual traditions.
Well, it certainly is.
And what are your thoughts about whether there will ever be, you know, a meeting of the minds, a reconciliation between what we call science and what we call spirituality?
Well, I think they're very close as it is today. When you're talking about actually, obviously we're not talking about just simple religion in this case,
right,
with theology involved. But when you're talking about scientists who are on the cutting edges of science, I mean, really science has moved into a realm of where it's not about just pure, simple matter anymore. It used to be we were talking purely about material objects that pretty much could be seen with the eye or, you know, microscope at best. But now, of course, we've gone to these subatomic particles and, you know, the whole concept of quantum, the collapsing of a quantum event.
Right.
These ideas are really pushing the envelope to the point that spirituality and the quantum view, at least, of the world have a lot in common.
Now, I think that, I mean, again, from my own perspective, to me, it seems as if there's a dam that's getting ready to burst. And the dam is this breakthrough that may occur, that should occur, where the leading scientific thinkers finally recognize that they can't do away with consciousness, mind, spirit, whatever ephemeral subject they want to call it, that has to be part of a scientific worldview. I mean, as you know, from people like Amit Goswami, who was a guest on the show a couple weeks ago, and many others, there are plenty of quote-unquote quantum physicists who undeniably see a role for consciousness in the scientific worldview. But as it's at the same time, I would make that observation. There are the leaders, the ones that are writing the textbooks, to me, are hardcore materialists. And to me, that is the problem we're having right now. If you read Stephen Hawking, for example, had that article in the Wall Street Journal a year or so ago. It was entitled "There Is No Heaven," for example. And then I think there was another one where it said, you know, we don't need God anymore in our equations, and so on and so forth. What are your views on whether at some point in time there will be this convergence or there will be a breakthrough, or is it just me imagining things or me being hopefully, you know, overly optimistic, I think is the right way to put it.
I think one of the things that has been demonstrated about the scientific approach particularly is that a lot of what is interpreted as a result really depends on the interpreters. And so you'll find in the scientific community people doing the exact same science. But, you know, you had an interview with Amit Goswami, who's also, he's a member of the Theosophical Society, but he's someone who is, you know, he's doing the research and he's talking about how, you know, quantum physics demonstrates the existence of God, for instance.
Right.
Which is not something that someone doing the exact same science would necessarily arrive at that conclusion.
Yeah.
So I think whether you talk about science or whether we talk about the scientists who are doing the interpretation, I think sometimes those are two different things. And I don't think it really is, I don't think it's so different in the practice of science as it is in the practice of religion or business or anything else, where always you're going to have people who see things differently.
Yeah, you can't get around the fact that there's always a human being doing the interpretation. That's so true. But I think what happens is that when the leading scientists, professors, and it's not just scientists. I don't want to criticize that field of thought too much because it happens in any field.
No, but I think science clearly is one of the most powerful things leading human thinking today.
Yeah. There's no doubt though that when they write it in the textbooks, it becomes gospel. That's the problem because even though a certain professor gave his subjective interpretations, becomes a textbook, and it becomes, as I said, it becomes the gospel. And then when you try to look at it maybe with an open mind, it's a lot more difficult rewriting a textbook than it is convincing the guy who wrote the book or convincing you know, others to write competing books of equal stature.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a real problem. I want to ask you in terms, you know, you travel a lot, right? As in your role as president
of
the Theosophical Society. What do you see as the main obstacles to people understanding what theosophy stands for?
Well, I mean, you could say theosophy, or you could say genuine spirituality, and I think it would be synonymous, whether it's some other movement or the Theosophical Society.
Right.
The obstacles today are really not that much different than they have ever been, really. And I think one of the main obstacles that people encounter today, as in the past, is very often people feel awfully overwhelmed just in terms of what it takes to make it through just a normal day. Don't even talk about spirituality or an inner life. But there's a sort of overwhelming effort that seems to be demanded of people, so that very often it becomes really something of a luxury for people to think in terms of actually exploring some deeper aspect of themselves, to think in terms of actually cultivating those qualities that lead toward happiness for themselves and others, or peace.
Yeah.
So it's very demanding. So what the word that most people, that flows from their lips so easily, is this idea about the real world.
Right.
And of course, the real world is the world of struggle, strife, day to day, go to the job. And I think this sort of a lockstep thinking about what constitutes a real world really covers over the potential reality, which is a reality that speaks about qualities of, you could say, of compassion, or powers that are latent in each and every one of us.
Right.
That go on unregarded, and so they're uncultivated.
Right.
And then we find ourselves looking at people who seem to be models of this, you know, the Mother Teresas, the Dalai Lamas, you know, in the past, the Martin Luther Kings, Abraham Lincolns, those sorts of people, and thinking that they're just exceptional. They're different from me and you.
Yeah.
But if you ever really listen to anything that they're saying, the message in every case is that the very things that are possible for them are the same things. It's laying dormant through our own, you know, through no fault of anyone else, through our own inactivity or just inattention. So a little bit of attention in that direction can go a long way.
It's funny, because a couple of people we've had on the show, for example, we had Russell Targ,
mm-hmm.
who I know you're aware of, who is the...
published a book of his.
The former CIA guy, who is really one of the gurus in clairvoyance or remote viewing. One of his messages is that everybody has this ability, this remote viewing ability. If you tell your cousins that, they'll look at you like, are you strange or what? I mean, and then there's the guy who wrote the book Manifesting Michelangelo. I think his name is Joseph Pierce Farrell. The Saving Michelangelo, where he engaged in this healing power. This ability to physically heal people through touching has been videoed. It's all over the YouTube. He unquestionably has this power, and he says the same thing, that everybody has this innate power. And so, one of the things I really want to focus on is that to me, the reason to be open-minded about things like spirituality, theosophy, or Buddhism, or whatever, is that indeed there might be truth to all this. But if you close your mind to what I would call the power of the self, or the united mind, or whatever, you might be really missing out on something. And so, it's sort of like you alienate yourself from yourself by convincing yourself that you're just a little gene machine or mm-hmm. robot who lives for 70 some years and then quietly slips into the grave.
Right.
So your point about time is so vitally important, because I think that that's really the big problem. There's not a lot of people who have the benefit of stopping the action for a moment,
mm-hmm.
and quote unquote meditating or thinking about it, or reading or reading some books.
Yeah.
So this is but to the extent that this comes to the forefront, through people like Oprah Winfrey, who I think did it a little bit, and maybe some of these Shirley MacLaine or some of the Hollywood celebrities that have some clout, to the extent that we have people really advancing, promoting this point that you do have to sit back a little bit and look at yourself because there might be a richer world in there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's gonna be all for the better.
Well, I mean, the trend that I'm seeing is that a lot of people are finding that the places that they used to look for meaning are not perhaps answering to their particular needs at this time. And, you know, one of the things that you've mentioned, we were talking about earlier, is just how much people are swept up in this whole busyness.
Yeah.
That everybody seems to be involved in. I don't know anybody, quite honestly, who is not busy.
Right.
And it doesn't make any difference whether you have a job,
yeah.
or at home. It doesn't make a difference today.
Yeah.
It's just one of the symptoms of the time. But in spite of that, I mean, I know a lot of, I'm a busy person, but I know people who are much, much busier than I am. But what I don't know anybody who is so busy that they're not able to carve 15 minutes out of a day. And 15 minutes spent in very simple sorts of things, such as 15 minutes of just quietly watching the breath, 15 minutes of prayer, 15 minutes of meditation, attempted meditation. Done on a regular basis. I mean, anybody who could devote 15 minutes a day for 30 days wouldn't have to ask anybody whether there's any value here. They would know for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's just, in a certain way, I heard there's a teacher I respect greatly who talked about this tendency toward busyness. And in many ways, he characterized it not as just busyness, but really as laziness, in the sense that we're so busy with things that are really of lower priority to our own inner health and inner life. And so the things that might take a little bit more effort, we avoid. So really, it's more about laziness in terms of actually doing that which would benefit us, our family, our world, by not paying attention to some of these deeper things.
It all sounds so much like prioritization.
Well, it is.
It sounds so much like people, and I've seen it before, where someone has an inbox, and they'll pick the piece of paper that's most interesting, or that's most fun, and all the serious stuff gets left at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later that catches up to you in the business world, and maybe it catches up to you in the real world. But I think the point I would love you to address is that old American question, which is, what's in it for me? You know, that's really the question, because we have a lot of people who say, you know, meditation, it's something, I mean, it's pretty similar to exercising in a way.
Yeah.
Although you can sort of have some physical, benefits or actual benefits from exercising,
mm-hmm.
theoretically. But
if you exercise.
Yeah, exactly. If you just don't think about doing it. But why don't you address the question of what is, you know, how do you answer that question? For someone who says, "Oh, all this meditation and deep thinking and contemplation is great, but why? Well, what's in it for me?"
Well, yeah, and you know, I really think it's not a bad question at all. In fact, if the pursuit doesn't begin there, then probably it's an artificial pursuit. What is in it for us? And I think one of the basic things that everybody, you know, if you breathe, we all share at least this one quality in mind, and that is that every single one of us is looking to be happy. And, you know, we may go about it in some very strange ways that produce the opposite result, but it's not because we're not trying to create a environment that is happiness producing for us. And so with that as the motivation, what's in it for me? Well, I mean, when we look at the sorts of relationships that we have with other people, I mean, a lot of them involve varying degrees of strife and conflict. And what if that could be lessened? Not by changing somebody we have no control over, but by doing just a little bit of inner work, just a little bit. What if that could be lessened noticeably? That's something that, you know, what's in it for me, that would be quite a lot. And then, you know, if you further extend that, you know, those are the sorts of things that can carry you through any particular situation you face in life. Everybody is going to face crises. You know, there's no avoiding it. You know, nobody gets out of here alive, for one thing, but nobody gets out of here without encountering a host of different crises. And to just be able to feel as if, to some degree, within me, I have the capacity to face these and then to move through them, that's something that's worth an awful lot.
Yeah.
And so those are the sort of basic things that come out of just a, you know, just a little bit of attention to this.
And to me, it's sort of like, and Joseph Campbell, the great author of the Hero with a Thousand Faces, and probably the world's leading expert on myths. He thought that there is something in all of us that we are just sort of nipping at. I mean, he mentioned this metaphor about being on a whale and fishing for minnows, and that struck me as really a good sort of illustration of what we're trying to talk about right now, to me, which is you open your mind to the possibility that there may be more to life than the day-to-day frenzy and the short life, the unhappiness that many of us encounter, that there may be a bigger, richer world there. And it's sort of the same sort of sense that you could get through exercising, certain types of physical or life experiences that bring you to a higher consciousness. And I think that when you go there, when you experience the quote-unquote higher consciousness, as corny as that may sound, you become a fuller person. And therefore, you're going to be able to deal with adversity better because you're going to understand things better. Yeah, and so I think that to me, and you know, you mentioned earlier about Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King and the great spiritual leaders, you know, they had it, you know. They had it, and I think Buddha is probably one of the best examples of it, right? He was the guy that sort of tried to throw out of his mind all of the distractions and focus on the internal, the internal. So, again, it does come back to this concept of being open to a greater power within. So I'd like to, at this point, just talk to you a little bit about where you believe the new age is. I mean, people, I don't know if new age is still a term that's in use. How it relates to spirituality or theosophy. I'm just wondering what are your views on what new age really means?
Well, I think the new age, generally, when it's used, it talks about, I mean, lumps a lot of different things together. But it generally tends to speak about alternative forms of spirituality or of, you know, spiritual practices or, you know, things like astrology and tarot, and right. a lot of those things would be lumped in.
Right.
Probably incorrectly.
Right.
But I think the primary idea is that people are, who would be termed New Age, are looking outside generally of the normal religious traditions
right.
for some sense of a spiritual belonging or spiritual understanding or experience. I think that one of the things that does characterize a New Age approach is it's been made possible largely because the world has really shrunk in ways that would not have permitted something like this before. I travel, and probably there is no city that I go to where you can't find authentic teachers of Tibetan Buddhism, Hinduism, Sufi, you know, the whole range, Zen, the whole range of religious and spiritual traditions are present everywhere. So it's enabled people to sample and to pick things out of one, apply it to another. And so a lot of times you get people who have a very, very broad sort of approach to spiritual practice. But oftentimes it's broad, but it's not particularly deep. And that's one of the issues that I think kind of plagues what's traditionally spoken of as New Age, because a lot of it is, you know, just from my own point of view, is very much focused on the self. And yep. to the extent that often it's, you know, it's just out and out selfish.
Yeah.
And so as a result, it's not something that, you know, everybody wants to feel good. But, you know, the sorts of fixes for feeling good that become the common prescription, you know, are a whole sort of varieties of just different ways to manipulate the universe to get what I want.
Yeah.
And in the name of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a drawback. But oftentimes, you know, it's a necessary drawback because it's what where people find themselves at that moment.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the problems that we're having right now, I think in our current day and age, is what to call this field that is sort of outside of normal religion. Mm-hmm. But shades into religion, and it shades into philosophy, and it shades into science. And I asked you that question about the New Age because the problem I think we have with the concepts, which is New Age, and I think you got to put theosophy in there, and I think spirituality you have to put in there. I think there's something called the New Spirituality that Neil Donald Walsh may be heralding. And there's and I think there's something called quantum philosophy or quantum thinking or something, but all of them seem like they're sort of outliers, and mm-hmm. and I think that that's so we have sort of this battle going on between science, which most people believe they understand but probably don't, mm-hmm. Versus whatever else there is out there. And you could call it New Age, and as you said, New Age has some bad connotations. And then spirituality sounds—it's the best term, I think—but it sounds a little like it's touchy-feely, ephemeral. You can't really measure it. And then theosophy, as I said, has a very rich history, but also I think it has some aspects of a sect-like connotation that may turn people off, and I want everybody to understand. I didn't say this in the beginning, but I am a member of the Theosophical Society, and I want to tell you the reason I am is because they basically accept anybody who's it's non-dogmatic, and I love it when it says it right in their founding principles that we don't tell you what to think. I think that's a beautiful. Foundation there. But anyways, I went off a little bit. But Tim, what do you think we should call this, or what would you call it? I mean, or it's just a matter of getting people to be more open-minded about how to interpret whatever this field is we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You put your finger on something that is, in fact, a difficulty. And I don't know that I would necessarily have a term, but I think terms are probably important. But yeah, I think people, as I say, lump many, many things into this overall category. And I think in many ways, it does a disservice to some of the things that find themselves lumped in there. Well, theosophy, obviously, I would think would be one of those things.
Right.
'Cause one of the profound differences to me, and the thing that also made it theosophy attractive, is, as you say, first of all, it's non-dogmatic. And its emphasis is on the unity of humanity in terms of its religion, science, and philosophy. So it's broad, but also it's quite specific in the sense that, you know, it speaks about dimensions of our being, and it is something that is pretty easy to track in a sense. It's not so mystical in the sense that it's talking about how we're composed, you know, not just the physical body, but these other dimensions of our being that we're aware of, but we have somehow not been supplied the sort of ideas to speak about it. You know, the emotional life, the emotional body, those experiences that we have in dreams that everybody has. You know, those are the sorts of things that it is able to help us to understand more deeply. And then most of all, the most powerful tool we have, which is our mind, and the qualities and the powers of the mind and of our thought, are things that often just go neglected because really it's rather unknown and unspoken to in other traditions.
It seems to me that, I mean, I think the terminology is a real problem. And again, my own view is that the best solution would be to have science evolve where it would encompass what we call spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, for example, we've had this long-standing problem with the paranormal in science. And the paranormal, I would include things like the placebo effect, and I would include that healer I met, Joseph Pierce Farrell.
Yeah.
And I would include Russell Targ. And then there's Dean Radin, and Charles Tart, who've done unbelievably rigorous scientific studies of the paranormal. And the scientific community, though, just does not accept it. Just does not accept it because it doesn't fit their model.
Well, I think it's less... I think that we will reach a point where much of this will be accepted, because I really believe that, you know, just like we have seen the progress of science in the sense of unless it's something that is measurable and repeatable, then it doesn't really fall within the purview of today's science. But they've become more and more able to measure and detect and observe, you know, ever finer and finer layers, more subtle layers of matter.
Yeah.
And I'm certain that as this progresses, you know, the matter that is involved in the composition of this healing energy will be observable and measurable, as will, you know, thoughts, as will the quality of the sorts of energies that are related to emotions and feeling. And as we move to that point, then it'll no longer be called spirituality or metaphysics. Then it will be embraced by science.
Yeah.
But, you know, even with that, you're still dealing with matter, just finer matter.
I think people forget sometimes that science itself is really riddled with high order speculative theories, and included among those would be string theory and the multiverse, and it's a whole nother topic, and we don't have time to get into those, which I'm sure you'd be excited to talk about with me, but my point is that science itself engages in speculation about otherworldly phenomena, that that cannot be proven. And and there's a very good book on string theory called The Trouble with Physics, written by a leading physicist, Lee Smolin, which I've mentioned before, that basically criticizes string theory as being overly dominating for a theory that can never be proven. Mm-hmm. And that's what he says in the book. And then multiverse is the same thing. Even though there's a bunch of folks who are lining up to support it, the consensus is it can't be proven because it's necessarily beyond our physical universe itself. And so it's not as if science itself, what we notice science doesn't deal with the unobservable. And I haven't even mentioned dark matter, dark energy, but all we're talking about is something that is observable, such as remote viewing, mm-hmm. or this psychic phenomena. It is testable, but it doesn't fit the model. So it's a very interesting dynamic we have going on right now in the science paranormal debate, which is very interesting. A lot of really good writers, a lot of good books in that area that continue to draw a lot of attention. So before we end, I have to ask you about the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama has come up before in some of the shows as being sort of an example of a great modern thinker. On last week's show, Professor Jay Garfield, who's the lecturer on the teaching company for the Meaning of Life shows, he has a couple of lectures on the Dalai Lama, and I know you've met the Dalai Lama. Is that right?
On a couple of occasions, yeah.
And you were instrumental in having him come to Chicago. Was it last year?
Yeah, it was last July. The Theosophical Society hosted him in Chicago.
Yeah. Now I guess, and this is sort of a it's somewhat of an unfair question, but I know that most people who hear about the Dalai Lama, of course, he's written 20, 30 books. He's very educated. He's a great writer, and I think that he's really something else for being a religious leader and being so intellectually attuned. But the theory is that he's a reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. Is that right?
Well, actually, the theory is yes, but in Tibetan Buddhist belief system, he's the reincarnation of Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezi, who is the Buddha of enlightened being of compassion.
Okay.
And that's the one who actually reincarnates in each Dalai Lama. So it would be the 13th as well as the 14th.
I would assume that the Dalai Lama believes that he was reincarnated or he is reincarnated.
Well, actually, when you hear him talk about it, he's very, he will tell you that because it's his tradition, he accepts it. But in terms of personal knowledge, he knows that he was designated because he showed certain signs that seemed to speak to that. But he never claims that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, that would be just like him, because I heard, and I think it was Professor Garfield who was giving the story about the Dalai Lama, about how after the 13th Dalai Lama passed away, there was a search for his successor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, well, how do you find the new Dalai Lama? By searching the hills. It's a very interesting feature, and I'm not saying it's not possible for him to be reincarnated or whatever. I think the reincarnation is a possibility, but I was just wondering what he had said about it, and I think it's very interesting that he sort of is going with the program, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
He makes no claims, but it is Tibetan tradition. They do. I mean, they have a long line of, and there's a method to it, but it doesn't. It's not something that relates to normal Western practice. I mean, they'll do divinations that will determine the area, and they'll have signs of what the person might look like, and then they always go to this one particular lake, one of the sacred lakes in Tibet, where they will go, and they always see signs, see visions of things that would tend to place the future Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
So they go on that basis, which probably is not something that would satisfy many scientific people.
Yeah, he stands on his own, though. He's really accomplished a lot in his life. So before we close, I'd just like to ask you one. I think the last question is, what do you see as the future of the spiritual society or the theosophical society? Or maybe you guys will change your name to something that will be more.
I'm going to wait on you. We're going to put you in a name contest.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think there's anything really wrong with theosophy. It does have a sense of depth to it. But anyways, what do you think is the future of theosophy in this country?
Well, I think, you know, all indications to me are that theosophy is something that more and more is going to be sought out. You know, theosophy and the allied sorts of study and practices involved. Most important thing to me always is not necessarily that, you know, our membership roles swell.
Right.
But that the basis for it, which is really to try and create this nucleus of the human family based on the principle that we are connected, and that's something that can be experienced if we but try.
Yeah.
So if that's something that can be developed and, you know, appreciated more so, then I think the work of the Theosophical Society, whether it people even know the name, is being done. And I see things actually moving in that direction, quite honestly.
Well, I think that if things move the way we hope they will, which is towards a integration between science and spirituality, then theosophy is definitely going to be a big part of that. Now, in closing, I'm going to recite here the Theosophical Society's three objects, and just to show people that it's hard not to accept these. Here's the first one: to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. Okay, that one sounds like the Declaration of Independence to me. Number two, to encourage the comparative study of religion, philosophy, and science. I think we need more comparative studies of those three areas. And here's the third one, more controversial: to investigate unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in humanity. Okay, no, again, that's sort of what science does.
Well, of course.
That's sort of what science does. But the powers latent in humanity is maybe where things are a little different, but that's what we've been talking about on today's show, which is if we begin with an open mind and we sort of look inside and question some of our conditioned beliefs, if we spend a little time with the big questions, we may find indeed that there are powers hidden away that will help us in our day-to-day lives, that will give us a greater appreciation of who we are and a richer sense of the world we live in. This is Philip Mirton. Tim, I'd like to thank you for joining me today for this interesting discussion on the future of spirituality in our U.S. of A. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you so much.
This is Philip Mirton, and welcome to our segment called Something More. Now, here we try to mix things up a bit by taking a quick look at some of the ideas, products, and services that relax, challenge, and open the mind. Very happy to have as our guest today Robin Beck, who is the co-director of Kima Global Publishers out of Cape Town, South Africa. Welcome to the show, Robin.
Thank you, Philip. Lovely to be here.
Let's get into Kima Publishing for a moment here. First of all, what is the mission of Kima Publishers?
Well, our mission, which we started some years back, was to publish books that make a difference to people's lives. And at the beginning and from to this day, we find that a lot of authors out there who have got really serious messages and are also actively networking in the world, that they don't have that sort of vehicle to get their books into the right places. So we specialized in that, and we've had obviously a lot of positive response to it. And we're still here. It's in our 20th year this year.
Well, that's great. Since you've been doing this now, how has the publishing world changed?
Oh, you know, absolutely radically. You know, when I started, we were still doing only litho print runs, and then we used to ship books around the world, you know, there were inevitable problems with, you know, customs and shipments getting hijacked and distributors going under and all sorts of things like that. That, you know, it's a lot easier now. The market is very much open in the world because of the technology, the way we send files across and we print in different places. So as a result, we're starting to attract authors from many other countries, you know, from everywhere from New Zealand to Austin, Texas, and Ohio, and other places as well.
Now, what kind of books are you looking for? I've looked on your website, and you have a number of books in, I guess I would call it sort of the New Age spiritual genre, and I'm not sure what you would call it, but what types of books are you looking for, and how would you characterize the genre that you're in?
Oh, gosh, no, it's actually very wide to give you that answer, but it used to be called New Age, but we don't do that anymore because it's so much wider. So now it's really spiritual and alternative subjects that would include everything from, you know, from sort of alternative new economics to channeled work even, and some fiction, obviously.
Yeah, I noticed that. And now, what led you to open up your own publisher?
Well, I suppose it's an interesting story because I've spent something like 25 years in print. And the last few years of that, I had a partnership with three other guys, and we essentially were the production house for about eight small independent publishers. So we handled all of that for them. And as things happened in the world, the partnership came to an end. Various, you know, not difficult reasons, but, you know, the one retired and our printer sold his business, and so things changed. And so, you know, it was quite an easy step then to step from one side of the desk to the other side. And by then, I'd had quite a lot of contacts in the publishing world and also in the writers of the genres that we would be interested in.
Now, what do you think separates Kima Publishers from other publishing companies? Obviously, you're smaller and you deal with sort of maybe forgotten books or books that are getting less attention. But is there something that separates your company from other publishers?
I suppose the first thing that we get the response from is that our authors get an amazing amount of personal attention, you know, from beginning to end. You know, we regarded it as almost a cooperative process in that they're involved quite a lot of the way. They approve the covers, and although we do have a veto on anything, if somebody wants to do something totally senseless, we press the button and we said no, absolutely no. But by and large, you know, we need their help because they also need to be proud of their product. So, you know, and I suppose that is the difference. People feel at home. We call it actually the Kima Global family of published of authors, because they do have interactions between each other and they sort of help each other along the way, which everyone needs a bit of help now and again.
Now, in what way do you think your books are making a difference in the world?
I suppose, you know, it's actually, you know, through the authors themselves, they, you know, have a vehicle. I don't know how many, obviously, people we have affected, but, you know, over the years, we have sold a lot of books. We've sold perhaps somewhere between 500,000 and a million books over that period. And those people's lives must have been affected, we think.
Yes. Well, my own view is that we need publishers, companies like Kima Global Publishers, to get the word out, because the mainstream publishers often overlook some excellent writing, some new ideas that are breaking new ground. And I see on your website you have quite a few books that appear to be very appealing. And before we close, why don't you just mention a couple of your new listings and then tell the listeners how they could learn more about Kima Publishers.
Well, what are our new listings? Our new listings are, first of all, which we regard as a wonderful start with that is a book called New Creation by John Poynton, because, you know, it addresses the subjects that we're all very fond of here, you know, the interface between spirituality and nature, really. And because it is atmospheric in that it takes place in the African bush, which has often a profound effect on people that visit it. You know, they come away changed people. So that is one of them. I think another one might be Tarot Dynamics Unleashed from a woman called Anna Cook in from Ohio. And she is very active in tarot and has had a good response because her book seems to be very different to many of the others that are out there or competing with this space. And so I suppose those two for a start. Then, you know, just, you know, you will mention the websites before we close, I suppose, or should I do that?
No, go right ahead. Why don't you mention it?
We really have two websites that are of interest. The one is www.kemaglobalpublishers.com, which is really addressing the publishing issue. It's about our authors, what we do, what we don't do, how we work in the world. And the other one is www.kemaglobalbooks.com, which is really our product range, catalog and product range. So that's more of a commercial site. Those two are the prime places to see.
Well, thank you very much for this short talk, Robin, about Kema Publishers and the unique niche that your company has in the publishing business. Those listeners, as Robin just indicated, who are interested in learning more about what Kema does, what they publish, and their books, can find them, as Robin said, on Kema Publishers website. I just Google KIMA Publishers and out pops the website. So I'd like to thank you very much for spending some time with us. And once again, this is Philip Mirton for Something More on Conversations Beyond Science and Religion. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Mirton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heavenattheendofscience.com.